This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington, in for Neil Conan. Anyone claiming to have a blueprint to rid the world of extreme poverty by the year 2025 must be either a genius or delusional, right? Economist Jeffrey Sachs has been called both, but he firmly believes poverty can be eradicated within a generation. And he's got the resume to back up that claim. During the 1980s and 90s, Sachs was credited with turning around the economies of struggling countries like Bolivia and Poland with a prescription that came to be known as shock therapy. He's also served as an economic advisor to other governments throughout Latin America, Eastern Europe, Asia, Africa, and the former Soviet Union, where shock therapy was much less successful. In recent years, Jeffrey Sachs has become a leading voice on the subjects of struggling economies and attacking poverty. He's now special advisor to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan on global poverty, and he's the author of the recent book, The End of Poverty. In it, he argues that economic success does not necessarily prove the superiority of the country or culture that achieves it, and that with the right recipe of internal reforms and external help, all countries can make it high enough up the economic ladder to effectively end global poverty. What one measure would you like to see the international community enact to improve the problem of global poverty? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Jeffrey Sachs joins us now from our New York bureau. Thank you for being on the show, Professor Sachs.
Thank you, John. It's great to be with you.
Let's start first by defining poverty. It after all, is a relative measure. People who are poor and in poverty in the U.S. aren't the same as people who are poor elsewhere in the world.
That's absolutely right. And I start the book by describing three kinds of poverty. The extreme poverty, which is the focus of the book, moderate poverty, and the kind of relative poverty that we're more familiar with in the United States. Extreme poverty can be summarized in my view as poverty that kills. It's poverty that's so extreme that people don't have reliable access to the most basic needs, food, safe drinking water, emergency health care when they need it. Moderate poverty grips a large part of the world. It's the kind of poverty you would see looking at slums in Latin America. People may have enough to eat. Their life expectancy indeed may be 70 years or more, but still they lack so many of the things that we would take for granted in our lives. Then in the United States, there's no doubt poverty, but we define poverty as people that are not part of the mainstream of life because their income levels are perhaps half or lower than the average of the country. And this creates indignities, it creates hardships, it creates a lot of struggle. It generally does not mean mass starvation and mass death due to poverty, which is what extreme poverty causes on the planet and leads to millions of people dying simply because they're too poor to stay alive.
And when you talk about alleviating or eradicating poverty by 2025, are you talking about eradicating all forms?
No, I'm not. The world would still have lots of places that by the standards of America would be quite poor. But I'm talking about eliminating the poverty that kills. I'm talking about eliminating the poverty that deprives people of even the first foothold in the global economy. And that kind of poverty grips around a billion people on the planet. It's enough to care about. It's leading to massive suffering and, of course, profound instability in all parts of the world, though the epicenter of it is in Africa.
Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about really ending extreme poverty as opposed to moderate poverty as well?
What we see, and this is very important, is that other than the places in extreme poverty, the places that have moderate poverty, the middle-income countries, or indeed, our own kind of society, the United States, Europe, Japan, and so forth, the high-income countries, we're seeing fairly reliable economic growth in those places as long as the basic rules of political stability and economic management are observed. But in the very poorest places, that's not the case. What we're seeing in the very poorest places of the world is often a downward spiral of disease, hunger, environmental degradation, instability and violence, and even more poverty. So the point that I'm making is that not only could the extreme forms of suffering be alleviated by our generation, and this would be a breakthrough, of course, of historic significance, but it would also put all parts of the world on a reliable basis for further economic development, of course, assuming good management and good politics, but at least it would not prevent these places from gaining that first foothold on the way up the economic ladder.
We want to remind our listeners that we want to hear their opinions on fighting poverty. Our number is 1-800-989-TALK, 1-800-989-8255. Professor Sachs, in your book, you painted some vivid pictures of people suffering under these forms of poverty, and I wonder if you could just take us for a few moments to a couple of those countries where you saw extreme poverty, and then you painted other pictures of economies that were just getting going and provided some contrast as to what was happening and what was changing to make a difference.
Extreme poverty is not hard to find if you look out for it. I recount a visit in the spring of 2002 to a village in Malawi, but I've just come back from similar visits in Kenya and Ethiopia and Senegal, so there's nothing unique about recounting in the book. In Malawi, it was a village in a region beset by drought. That's happening also where I just was in Ethiopia. It's a village beset by endemic malaria. In other words, malaria year-round affecting virtually everybody. This is par for the course in large parts of Africa. It was a village beset by AIDS, and of course, this is also a pandemic throughout most of Africa. This is what Carol Bellamy vividly and rightly described as the perfect storm of development. You have climatic shocks, environmental degradation, massive disease, chronic hunger. And Malawi, which also helps to explain the poverty, is a landlocked country. That's also very often par for the course, because being landlocked means that it's a country that doesn't have easy, ready access to international trade, one of the surest ways out of poverty. So this is a country, as part of a broader region, sub-Saharan Africa, that is beset by challenges of growing enough food, especially in a situation of rain-fed rather than irrigation-led agriculture, a place struggling with the disease burden, AIDS, malaria, TB, and many other killer diseases, and a place struggling with economic isolation. Those are the risk factors, I would say, that help to account for much of the extreme poverty that we find on the planet. And one of the main points of the recounting that situation is to explain what could be called the geographical or the structural features that help to account, not that bar progress, but that help to account for the situation that Malawi's in. But then I talk about places that are in various stages of transition, if you like, and helps me to think of it as walking up a ladder of technology or a ladder of living standards. Malawi, Ethiopia, they're not really even on the first rung of the ladder of development. They're looking up wondering, how do we get on that ladder? Whereas Bangladesh, where I describe a visit, is a country that's very poor, but it's making reliable progress right now. Mm-hmm. It's making reliable progress because it is moving, in fact, from extreme duress in the countryside to a significant amount of urban-based, export-led growth, in this case in humble sector, but one that has started off so many countries in the world, that is the textile and apparel sector.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk more about that later, but I'd like to get our listeners involved. We've got Jesse on the line from Santa Cruz, California. Jesse, you're on the air.
Yeah, I am on there. I'm on a cell phone, so I hope this this makes it.
Sure. You have a comment or a question?
Yeah, my comment and the question, and I'll take it off the air, is about relates the public opinion to economic policies. It seems like to me, and in order to understand poverty now, you have to take it in the historical context. I think as far as back as the colonial days of Europe and the impacts that we are still seeing that has had.
You're talking about colonialism?
And we can see.
Whoops, I think we lost Jesse. What about colonialism? Is it one of the causes of poverty?
Well, colonialism certainly had its role. It often suppressed education and indigenous leadership in places that were subject to colonial rule. But there are lots of former colonies now that are on the way of rapid economic development, some that are quite rich, of course, Singapore and Hong Kong being two examples. Colonialism can explain certain things, but it doesn't explain the broader picture of who's poor and who isn't poor. It's just, in that regard, one small part of a larger puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were beginning to describe the difference between Malawi and the Bangladeshes of the world. We've only got a minute before we have to go to a break, but give us just a couple of examples, and we can come back to it when we come back.
Well, of course, Bangladesh has manufacturing exports now, and next door to Bangladesh is India. They have high-tech exports now, the famous booming IT sector. So you see progress from basic industry to very sophisticated industry, and that's the walk up the ladder of development.
We'll talk about how to get there. We're talking with Jeffrey Sachs about his proposal to end global poverty in our lifetimes. If you've lived in or traveled around the third world, what do you think is most needed? Give us a call. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington. We're talking with economist Jeffrey Sachs about his proposal to end global poverty in the next 15 years. Make that about 20 years, 2025. In this plan, small efforts like mosquito nets and agricultural improvements can have a huge impact. What one issue do you think would have the greatest impact on global poverty? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. That's our email address is totn@npr.org. Professor Sachs, let's go to a caller right away, and then we'll come back to you. We're going to go to Aaron in San Francisco, California. Aaron, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
You have a question or comment?
I have both a comment and a question, and I'll try to make it as fast as possible. I serve on the board of directors of a United Nations Association chapter in East Bay, California, in Berkeley, and we're working on a Millennium Development Goal awareness campaign, and hopefully eventually we'll create a petition calling for the U.S. government to adhere to a promise that George Bush made at the 2002 Financing for Development Conference in Monterey, California, where he pledged to increase official development aid to, I believe it was 0.26%. So hopefully that will get underway. And also my question deals with profiting off of poor countries. I believe in 2003, Kofi Annan made a statement to the effect of that in 2002, poor countries made a net financial resource transfer to developing countries to developed countries, and furthermore, in 2002, it was the largest ever, exceeding $200 billion. So I'm wondering how that's happening. How are the rich making money from poor? And I suspect it has a role to do with the private sector and perhaps the role of the corporation in today's globalized era. So I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Professor Sachs, are those numbers correct? And is it part of the cause of poverty in the third world?
Well, I want to thank Aaron for reminding everybody that Actually, President George Bush signed up, as did all the other countries, to something called the Monterey Consensus. Actually, the Monterey Consensus said that the rich and the poor countries should work together to solve these problems of extreme poverty. And what my book and the UN Millennium Project report that I directed together with many, many scientists from around the world found was that with the help from the United States and other rich countries that has been promised but not delivered, made as practical investments in growing more food, fighting disease, overcoming economic isolation, poverty can be reduced sharply by 2015 and, as I'm arguing, ended by 2025. But we're not following through on those commitments. In fact, the American people aren't even aware of them because the president doesn't explain to the public that indeed we have signed on to a target of 0.7% of our gross national product as development assistance. That's 70 cents out of $100. Not an outlandish commitment, but we're only achieving 15 cents, the lowest rate of assistance per dollar of GNP of any rich country in the world, surprisingly enough. Mm-hmm. And it's the lack of that help that means that the poorest countries, even when well-governed, are unable to fight the chronic cycles of famine by proper investments in the rural agricultural communities. They're unable to fight the disease pandemics like malaria and AIDS and other killers. They're unable to even get the roads and the communications to break out of economic isolation. So without our help, the poorest of the poor are in a downward spiral. But we've promised to do it. We just haven't followed through. Now, with regard quickly to Aaron's comment about the rich world taking resources from the poor, I think as a general matter, it's fair to say that trade works in both directions for the rich and the poor. But where the poorest of the poor have suffered is from a massive debt burden that they can't pay and that the rich world has talked for years about releasing them from, but has not yet done. And so the debts continue to be collected, even when the debt payments are larger than the combined budgets for fighting disease and for educating young children. And this is in nobody's interest to be bleeding these countries dry when they're facing such horrific struggles against disease and such great challenges to get a foothold in development.
Now the George Bush and the White House have suggested that the institutions like the World Bank no longer make loans, but instead make grants to countries in poverty so that they don't have these huge debt burdens. Is that a good idea?
It's an excellent idea. It's an idea that I recommended, actually, together with Alan Meltzer on a commission that we both served on and which showed that we could have a bipartisan approach to foreign assistance. It was a commission that reported in the year 2000. The problem is that the World Bank and the IMF require our level of assistance to them so that they can then make those grants that the White House is suggesting. So the idea of grants rather than loans is an excellent idea. But then behind the scenes, the United States is actually putting the brakes on the significant increases of funding for institutions like the World Bank, which would allow the bank through a grant mechanism to actually help impoverished farmers grow more food or to help impoverished countries fight disease. So, yes, the concept is good, but the follow-through of the administration is not good. Indeed, it's not even there.
Let's go back to these examples that you had. Malawi in extreme poverty, Bangladesh in moderate poverty, but moving up. How do you get Malawi, the Malawis of the world, on the road up so that they can experience the kind of growth that a Bangladesh is and alleviate the suffering of their people the way Bangladesh is?
One of the things that I recount when we visited a village in Bangladesh is that we asked the women there, part of a self-help group, how many children they wanted. And almost to a woman, they answered two. But 30 years ago, the answer might have been as many as we can have, and the average would have been around six. So the fertility rates came down sharply on a voluntary basis because the girls got an education, became young women who wanted economic opportunities rather than a lifetime of raising six impoverished children. because the children had greater survival. So poor parents had more confidence to have fewer children knowing that they would survive because the women have more economic opportunities, including the jobs in the apparel sector in Dhaka, because contraception is available, often for free or at highly subsidized rates. And by reducing the fertility rates, by empowering young women through education, by saving children so that they grow up healthy and families have fewer of them confident that the children will survive, by fostering new industries, that's what put Bangladesh on a path, albeit at a low rung of the ladder, but up the ladder. Malawi could do the same thing. It's practical investments in agricultural productivity, in education of young children, in fighting the diseases which are now claiming the lives of 200 children before their fifth birthday out of every 1,000 that are born, of fostering industry by having transport and communication, even basic transport and communication, so that Malawi can get into new sectors just as Bangladesh has. The point that I would stress is that when you do a proper and careful diagnosis, what my wife, who's a pediatrician, taught me is called a differential diagnosis. So you look at the specific circumstances of the particular country and the reasons for its poverty. Practical solutions also are elicited by that diagnosis to produce more food once one knows the agronomic problems, to fight disease, to overcome economic isolation. And some places can do this on their own because their problems are not so severe that they're unconquerable out of their own resources. But other places need that first helping hand up to the first rung of the ladder of development. After that, the history shows they can walk up the ladder on their own. But to get up to the first rung, to have enough food to eat, to fight disease, to start producing for world markets in non-traditional sectors, that's where we could come in. And that's why we could be a catalyst, together with the poor countries, to ending extreme poverty.
Let's go to Steve, a caller from St. Louis, Missouri, for a question. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, so many of the problems, it seems like, and you've kind of already touched on the overpopulation, but so many of the problems of these poor countries seem to result from cases of extremely bad government and poor food distribution systems. And I have to wonder, if you don't take care of these underlying problems like overpopulation, like poor government, like poor distribution systems for food, and crazy ideas that, for example, there was a country, I believe, in Africa that was refusing to take grain that was sent to it because they were concerned that some of it might have been genetically modified. Before you can really address these issues of poverty, aren't you just going to simply be enabling these bad systems to continue and simply just, in effect, creating a worse problem down the line by if you feed more people, they have more children, and you end up having to feed even more people to keep them from starving, and the underlying system hasn't changed, and you're always going to have this problem unless you address these problems first, and they have to stick to the solutions.
Thanks for your question, Steve. Professor Sachs, how would you respond?
Excellent question, and there are some places where bad government really is the first obstacle to overcome. I'd say Zimbabwe, which is going to have a terribly conflictual election tomorrow because the government quite brutally is trying to hang on to power, an octogenarian leader who really should be going. But that's not a general fact. That is specific to some places. Countries like Ghana or Ethiopia or Senegal or Tanzania or Mozambique, first and foremost, they're impoverished. It's not that it's bad government or they have crazy ideas. Actually, I've heard more brilliant and insightful ideas in these countries than I could recount because the leaders are often crystal clear about the realities of the situation, but people are impoverished. The farms are depleted of, the soils are depleted of nutrients, and the farmers are too poor to be able to buy fertilizer. The overpopulation is a result of the fact that child mortality is so high that families are afraid to have fewer children, actually. And the irony is they're so risk-averse, they end up having more children even than compensating for the high mortality rates. It's a kind of trap, but one where we now have a lot of experience in overcoming. Help keep children alive, educate young girls, have family planning available, and you'll find, in fact, that population growth rates will slow and slow markedly. That's not bad government. That's extreme poverty. So we do have to distinguish between those, and we have to understand that development works. There are a lot of cases of great success. And in some of the places where development isn't working well, it's bad politics. But that's not a simple, broad, one-sentence explanation of the problems of extreme poverty. It's not even the main explanation. The main explanation is a trap that's due to all of the hardships of living in an endemic malaria region or in economic isolation or up in the mountains or in rain-fed agriculture or with the depleted soil nutrients. And that's why I put so much stress on seeing the problem, doing the careful diagnosis, talking in the communities, talking to the leadership, and why I stress that a lot of what comes out of Washington right now, especially the general antipathy to help and the general belief that aid isn't good, this is rhetoric by Washingtonians that never go to visit these villages. Frankly speaking, most of the Washington opponents of helping the poorest people simply have never seen a village and don't know what they're talking about.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Chuck in San Francisco for a question. Hello, Chuck. You're on the air. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Thank you very much. I've long wondered if, for countries that, as you describe, aren't even on the ladder yet, if those populations wouldn't be better served not by following a development path that sees them as participating in the global economy, but from being protected to some extent from the global economy and focusing on, certainly all the measures you've mentioned regarding health and appropriate use of technology, but really focusing on trying to develop a kind of a sustainable subsistence agricultural based economy that enabled them primarily to focus on giving everybody something to do and feeding themselves.
What do you think, Professor Sachs?
Well, Chuck, I think the first step indeed is a bit like that in the rural areas, because the first thing that happened in India or in China that unleashed real significant and very successful poverty reduction in recent years was a revolution in food productivity that enabled people to feed themselves. And so the first step out of extreme poverty in India goes way back to the 60s now, when food yields went way up by farmers having the ability to get higher yield seeds together with the fertilizer in that case and with irrigation. It was what was called the Green Revolution. What Africa needs from the production side, first and foremost, is to be able to grow more food. And this is feasible because the limits of food production right now are that the farmers are so impoverished they have no inputs, basically. They're just trying to grow crops on soils that absolutely can't produce more crops, and they're completely vulnerable to the vagaries of rainfall. And those vagaries are getting worse, most likely, because of long-term climate change. We're seeing a lot of drought and a lot of very fragile economies. But over time, when you solve the problems of extreme disease burden and food adequacy, people will want to do other things. They'll diversify out of staple food into commercial crops. They'll start doing woodworking and carpentry and food processing. And in the urban areas, they'll get into services and into manufacturing for export, and that will further raise their incomes. And that is an important part of moving from mere subsistence, which is better than what a lot of the most impoverished places have, actually to a climb to see their children not just finishing primary school, but secondary school. having the ability to have universities that can sustain the scientific efforts and the like. And these are what communities around the world want, and I think it is achievable for them.
We'll finish up our conversation with Jeffrey Sachs when we come back, and we'll also check in on the NCAA Women's Final Four, which starts this weekend. Two of the teams will be making their first appearance in the semifinals. Do you follow women's college basketball? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. I'm John Idsty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we want to finish up our discussion on eradicating poverty with Jeffrey Sachs, who is special assistant to the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and also director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. Professor Sachs, how are your measures, how is your program different from the program that's being followed by the UN and the World Bank at this point?
Well, just to be clear, this is not a UN program. This is a call for the rich countries to help the poor countries, both government to government and private individuals to private individuals. What's happening now is that the poor are being left to die. And the United States, our country, is not following through on our own promises. And the results are horrific and not appreciated, I'm afraid, within our country. This year, we'll spend $500 billion on the military, and our development aid for the poorest countries, maybe $5 billion, maybe one-hundredth of the military budget. And the result is no solution to the chronic hunger, to the disease burden, to the malaria, and to the instability that results from that. And somehow in Washington, they're confused why they can't get on top of this foreign policy situation. And the answer is if you pay $500 billion on the military approach to the problems in the world, but only $5 billion, one-hundredth of that $500 billion, for solving the deeper problems of people in anguish because they're hungry and they're dying, well, we're not going to get on top of these problems. And so what I'm recommending is let's rebalance what we're doing. Let's understand what we could achieve, how strong our technologies are, how we have promised to do more but haven't followed through, and how wondrous it would be not only, of course, for the people suffering today and watching their children die, and I've seen a lot of them as I visited the clinics and hospitals in Africa, but also how powerfully beneficial it will be for us as well to live in a world in which this kind of extreme suffering doesn't exist and is not leading to the massive instability that we see in so many impoverished parts of the world.
Thank you very much, Professor Sachs.
Oh, great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and author of The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. He joined us from our New York City Bureau.